from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency has determined that North Korea will have a reliable nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile by next year. That's according to a report yesterday by the Washington Post. At 9, we talk about North Korea's nuclear advances and the threats they pose. And then at 9:30, we'll discuss President Trump's speech to the Boy Scouts at their national jamboree earlier this week, where he criticized the fake media, as he called it, and talked about killing Obamacare in front of thousands of children and teens. It's all coming up next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. The Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency has determined that North Korea will be able to field a, quote, reliable nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile by next year. That's according to the Washington Post report yesterday. Earlier assessments found that North Korea would not have ICBM capability until 2020. Meanwhile, North Korea's state-run news agency also reported yesterday that Pyongyang would launch a nuclear strike at the heart of the United States if it tried to remove Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. The threat came in apparent response to CIA Director Mike Pompeo's statement last week that he hoped to find a way to separate the rogue dictator from his nuclear stockpile. In this segment, we want to discuss the status of North Korea's nuclear capabilities and how the international community may respond. Joining us is Robert Litvak. He's Director of International Security Studies at the Wilson Center in the nation's capital. His latest book is Preventing North Korea's Nuclear Breakout. And welcome, Robert Litvak. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is what may be some controversy about, just how capable North Korea is. You've been certainly talking about this as a challenge that's immediate and urgent, but we've been hearing from anonymous sources from defense and other parts of the government that it's not necessarily as serious now as perhaps some are characterizing it. In other words, there isn't the miniaturization for nuclear warheads. There isn't the range that some are saying. Can you really break this down for us? I mean, just how much peril are we in terms of getting hit here in the United States?
The recent ballistic missile test was a milestone in that it demonstrated North Korea's capability that's still nascent, but to develop a long-range ballistic missile that could strike the United States. But there are other critical components that you alluded to, the miniaturization of the warhead and mastering the reentry phase for a warhead that took the United States a protracted period to do. I mean, it's a complex technology. But let me put the current situation into a broader context. I've described it as a Cuban missile crisis in slow motion. That is, over the next several years, North Korea could obtain the capability to strike the United States with a long-range ballistic missile that will have mastered these different components that I alluded to and could have a nuclear arsenal of 100 nuclear warheads. That's about half the size of Great Britain's. And if you juxtapose that to the size of the North Korean economy, which is a paltry $40 billion, this is in a region with trillion-dollar economies, what you have with North Korea is a failed state with nuclear weapons. And unlike the Robert Kennedy's famous 13 days in October 1962, this crisis is going to play out over a number of years, and that creates political space, potentially, for diplomacy to constrain North Korea's capabilities.
Just want to mention, since you brought up North Korea's economy, I mean, there's been certainly a great deal of awareness here in the West about just how isolated they are and people starving and so forth. And yet the economy has been gaining at a pretty fast rate over the last 17 years, despite the sanctions and new sanctions just being passed. And largely this is because of mining and energy and increased exports to China. And China's role in terms of at least staving off this nuclear advance of North Korea's, President Trump met in Mar-a-Lago with the head of China and said we can use China and China can be an important ally here. But then he said China's not necessarily able to do as much as we can hope for. So what do we do in the wake of this nuclear advancement? I mean, I'd like you actually to talk about that nuclear advancement a little bit more before we get into options, because you've talked about strategic nuclear breakthroughs, both qualitatively and quantitatively.
Yes. I mean, North Korea has a mature nuclear weapons program. They've mastered both the plutonium and the enriched uranium routes to obtaining weapons usable material for their arsenal, which, according to unclassified projections, could grow to as large as 100. They conducted 25 ballistic missile tests last year, 2 nuclear weapons tests. So their tempo has increased. I mean, this isn't the Manhattan Project, but there is a new urgency to North Korean developments. North Korea evidently believes that it needs to attain the capability to strike the United States directly with a nuclear warhead, and it's on a trajectory to achieve that capability by 2020, which would be a game changer for the United States. But it would also be a game changer for China, and I think we can get into on the diplomatic options the new role that China might potentially play in seeking a diplomatic solution to constrain, not eliminate, but to constrain North Korea's the growth of their capabilities.
We're talking to Robert Litvak. He directs the International Security Studies at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about a report that the Pentagon believes that North Korea will have nuclear weapons that can reach America as soon as next year. And I ought to mention that they've talked about it possibly reaching Alaska, and there are preparations in Hawaii that are underway, concern about the possibility of North Korea's missile attack on Hawaiian Islands. The reality is, from many people's perspective, even though Mike Pompeo, as I mentioned in my introduction, Robert Litvak, has been talking about regime change, that there are really no good options.
There really are no good options. And really, what's the least bad of a bad set of options? I just would put the current crisis with North Korea into context. After the Cold War, our focus on threat shifted to the so-called rogue states, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Libya. And after 9/11, since 9/11, there's been a persisting tension in our policy of whether the objective toward these states should be to change their behavior or to change the regimes. And proponents of regime change have essentially argued that the dangerous behavior derives from the character of the regime. So if you want to turn off the threatening behavior, you really need to change the regimes. That argumentation, of course, was central to the case for preventive war in Iraq in 2003. In 2015, the United States concluded the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, that is the Iran nuclear deal, that constrains that country's capabilities, its access to weapons usable material for 15 years. And it's the Iranian program is much less advanced than the North Korean program, which actually has crossed the nuclear weapon threshold. But the template of diplomacy to constrain capabilities that was successfully applied to Iran could be applied to North Korea. And the irony is that the Iran nuclear deal, which President Trump as a candidate disparaged as the worst deal in history, could well be the template for constraining, capping, freezing North Korea's capabilities and preventing this strategic breakout by 2020.
There is a great deal of distrust here, though. I mean, not only on the part of the United States because of cheating that North Korea has done in the past, but also on the part of North Korea. I mean, when you read broadsides that come out of North Korea, and there's a lot of harsh rhetoric, but they also talk about the United States fooling Gaddafi back in 2003 and tricking him to sort of lay down nuclear weapons.
Right. I mean, in 2003, Libya, Gaddafi had given up his WMD capabilities. He had been scared straight, as the Bush administration at the time put it. But underlying the Libyan nuclear deal was a tacit but clear security assurance that if Gaddafi gave up his weapons, the United States would fall off of the objective of regime change in the wake of the Iraq war. In 2011, when NATO countries intervened in Libya and took down the Gaddafi regime, they didn't do it under a proliferation rubric. They did it under a humanitarian rubric because of the threat of mass killings in Benghazi. And that really complicated diplomacy with Iran as well as North Korea, that North Korea claimed, as you alluded to, that Gaddafi had been duped into giving up his capabilities. And therefore, getting to zero with North Korea, I mean, it's got an arsenal now in the mid-teens. Getting to zero is not a feasible a diplomatic objective as long as the Kim regime is in power. But getting them to freeze their capabilities, locking them in the teens, perhaps as many as 20 weapons, is better than an unconstrained program that grows up to 100. And the key to – and I lay it out in my new publication – I argue that the political space may well exist for such a freeze agreement that would preclude additional missile testing by North Korea, a freeze on nuclear weapons tests, and what would be particularly important but very difficult to achieve, putting a cap on North Korea's production of weapons usable material, that is plutonium and highly enriched uranium, so that this arsenal stays in the mid-teens and doesn't grow up to 100 weapons. And as much as non-proliferation policy, it's really making the best of a bad situation.
And you mentioned your recent publication, it's Preventing North Korea's Nuclear Breakout. That is actually accessible to our listeners on your website, the Wilson Center website?
Yes, for those not familiar with the Wilson Center, we're the nation's official memorial to our 28th president, created by an act of Congress. It's knowledge in the public interest and service, as our epigram goes, and our materials available at the popular price of free to the public on our website, and they can access it readily.
I'm sure you're aware there's a controversy going around about Woodrow Wilson's name because of racism and whether it ought to be on different memorials of one sort or another, but we won't go there. What we want to go is to more discussion about North Korea. And I'd like to invite our listeners to join this discussion. It's a half-hour segment. So if you have concerns, if you have things that you want to raise and bring to the conversation here, or if you have questions, please feel free to join us now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number to call is 866-733-6786. And again, if you have something you'd like to say or ask, now would be the time to call. Again, the toll-free number is yours. It's 866-733-6786. There are other ways you can join the program now. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments or your thoughts onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we do welcome your involvement and want to hear from you. Again, we're talking with Robert Litvak, Director of the International Security Studies at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. And before we go to our callers and our emailers, Robert Litvak, quick question about the young man, Otto Wehrmeier, who actually was a 22-year-old young man released in a coma after being a year in a North Korea prison. He was locked in for 15 years, supposedly at hard labor, and he came back allegedly for botulism, but he wound up dying, of course, and this is a terrible, brutal story. But the results are still, the consequences are still happening. I mean, there is no longer an ability for really Americans to travel in North Korea. What kind of difference is that going to make?
Well, this is an odious regime. There's no question about it. I mean, the treatment of the American student, the gulag system that they run. But it is essentially a failed state. There was a famine in the 1990s. There were predictions of regime collapse. At one point, the regime was pushing two meals a day. It's perverse in that, as The Economist reported, the typical 5-year-old in North Korea is now 9 centimeters shorter than his counterpart in South Korea. That is, a grotesque situation exists where because the caloric intake in North Korea is so low, there are now physical differences emerging between North and South Koreans. There has been some economic growth in North Korea that you alluded to, but this is within the context of a paltry economy. The CIA estimate, and it's hard to estimate the size of the North Korean economy because it's a barter economy, it's about $40 billion. That's the size of Dayton, Ohio. So imagine Dayton, Ohio with a nuclear arsenal half the size of Great Britain's. I mean, it's really an urgent situation. And if I could just take one minute just to lay out the main proposal kind of I delineate in my new publication, the reason why I think that diplomacy could lead to a freeze of the North Korean capabilities is a new set of factors that change the calculus of interest for the major parties. And I should just kind of backtrack one step, that basically there are three options in dealing with North Korea. bomb, negotiate, or acquiesce. And what's happened in the past is because the military option is so unattractive, that is, that it could lead to a general war on the Korean Peninsula. I mean, Pyongyang and Seoul is as close to the demilitarized zone as Baltimore is to Washington. And there's been reluctance to negotiate in different periods, or there have been impediments on both sides. We've ended up acquiescing essentially to North Korea building up its capabilities. And the current situation creates political space for diplomacy because a North Korean breakout would be a game changer not only for the United States but also for China because of the adverse strategic consequences for China. That is, South Korea and Japan might reassess their non-nuclear status. The United States would make further deployments in the region. So what would a freeze do, locking in North Korea at its current level? For China, it would retain North Korea as a buffer state, which is important to them, and it would avert these adverse strategic consequences. For North Korea, a freeze would keep the Kim regime in power and allow them to retain for the time being a small arsenal. And for the United States, a freeze agreement would be characterized as essentially an interim step toward the long-term goal of denuclearization. And that's what I think the United States should be moving toward, diplomacy aimed at freezing the capabilities, preventing the additional testing of missiles and nuclear weapons tests that would permit North Korea to retain a reliable capability that could strike the United States by 2020.
All right. I do want to go to your calls, and I did mention a ban now, these Young Pioneer Tours, which are out of China. There are up to 1,000
yes.
tourists each year who are not going to be going to North Korea. And there are also three citizens of the United States reportedly still in custody in North Korea. But let me bring our callers on here and go to Peter first. Peter, you're on.
Hi, yes. I'm wondering what your guests can say about North Korea's ability to target anything. This thing called the circular error probable, basically the size of the bullseye that you can effectively hit. And from the sound of the tests where they're just dropping things in the ocean, I'm guessing they haven't really been able to pin that part down. You know, the U.S. is a pretty big territory. If you land something in the middle of, you know, nowhere, it would be tragic, but, you know, it's a big difference between that and being able to hit a city deliberately.
Yeah, good, important question. Robert Litvak.
Great question. I mean, it really points to the technical reality that nuclear weapons acquisition is a complex, integrated set of technologies. And then we've seen demonstrable progress on ballistic missiles, but the other components are, and we've alluded to them already, the miniaturization of a warhead so it could fit atop a ballistic missile. And the estimate is that the missile that they recently tested, you could fit a single warhead and it would have a range of Alaska, Hawaii, the west coast of the United States. I know that's a non-trivial issue for those in your listening audience since they would become come under the potential target area of a North Korean capability. But this is complex technology, the reentry phase, let alone the questioner alluded to of the accuracy of the warhead, which may not be that important to North Korea. You know, the kinds of precise accuracies the United States aimed for during the Cold War and striking hardened Soviet targets. It was part of an elaborate deterrence system. North Korea may feel that just the ability to lob something and to strike the United States is sufficient. And this would be new for the United States. You know, there are two countries, two adversarial states that can directly threaten the United States with a nuclear attack, Russia and China. And we've lived with that for decades. There's a sense that these are deterrable states run by autocratic but kind of rational actors.
There's also mutual assured destruction involved, too.
And mutual assured capability there, to be sure. With North Korea, it's Americans don't respond well to vulnerability, and I'm President Trump and some in the administration have put down a marker that the United States, you know, it won't happen. As I recall, one tweet went. You know, a question of how the United States will respond to the possibility of being vulnerable to North Korean attack, and that would raise other options, which are really bad options in terms of their potential consequences of a military strike on North Korea's capability.
I have a question that I want to go to from a listener named Ben with you, Robert Litvak. He says, China's been amassing more and more troops on the Korean border. Could this be a sign that they are planning to intervene?
It's hard to say. I mean, North Korea's an opaque society. China's decision-making is opaque. China's main concern, as they've articulated, is that a crisis in North Korea could have
a huge flood of refugees for them.
So I would view the military deployments more within that context of securing their own border rather than as sort of the leading edge of some type of intervention capability. As welcome as many would find that if they could orchestrate a coup or whatever in North Korea. But they claim they have limited influence over the North Korean regime as it is.
Here's another caller. Dennis, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you. Since it seems like one of the big roadblocks is a fear of a conventional counterattack against Seoul and South Korea, what things can the military do to blunt that or to eliminate that? And are they working on that?
That's another great question. I mean, South Korea, the Republic of Korea, is very capable and advanced conventional capabilities. The concern with North Korea, I mean, there's been the focus on the nuclear program. But for many years, predating even 2006 when North Korea conducted its first nuclear weapons test, North Korea's had the functional equivalent of an atomic bomb pointed at Seoul. They've had forward-based artillery. And to remind, Seoul, the South Korean capital, is as close to the demilitarized zone as Baltimore is to Washington. I mean, it's very close. That has been a constraint on actions by the United States and South Korea when provoked by China. Recall that in 1968, they seized the naval vessel, the Pueblo. They've shot down reconnaissance aircraft. They've conducted, shelling of South Korean islands. And they know, the North Koreans know, that a constraint on South Korea and the United States is the concern that if the United States and South Korea were to retaliate, that it could lead to a general escalation. And Seoul is very vulnerable, being a capital so close to North Korea.
We have, unfortunately, very little time left here, Robert Litvak, but I've got a listener who wants to know how much help North Korea is getting from Russia on nukes and missile technology. Do we know?
They received their initial research reactor in Yongbyon. That's the facility. And that became the basis for their plutonium program. Since then, they've developed indigenous capabilities, but they are, and this should be noted, and the Washington Post pointed this out, they are reliant on Chinese companies for some missile components, and that's a potential source of leverage on North Korea.
Robert Litvak, I appreciate very much your being with us this forum segment, and I thank you once again and remind our listeners that Robert Litvak's newest book is out and available, and hope we can have you back on forum.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're going to be turning to a different subject in the segment up ahead. We're going to talk about the Boy Scout Jamboree speech that President Trump delivered the other day and get some responses to that. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.